Dean Sawson for extending the honor of hosting this exciting panel at this symposium honoring Dr. Asher Grunes. Usually when we think about balancing individual human rights against collective goals, we have in mind courts, or at least courts and tribunals. And certainly we have in mind the Supreme Courts of Israel, of Canada, and elsewhere. And in the classic separation of powers, we look to the judicial branch to perform the human rights role. But the judicial is not the only branch that protects, promotes, and balances human rights concerns. Today's panel looks at some of the other, often overlooked institutions. Who are these other human rights actors? Well, in the executive branch, there are the attorneys general. They have an obligation as chief law officers to advise on the legality and the constitutionality of bills and policy. And somewhat subsumed, there are, of course, the government lawyers, such as myself, who provide that confidential advice to the attorneys. In the legislative branch, there will be entities that report directly to the legislature. For example, the ombudsman, in some jurisdictions, the human rights commissioner. And as we will hear in Israel, which has neither an ombudsman nor a human rights commissioner, the gap in human rights review has been taken up by, of all people, the state comptroller, whose obligations include reviewing the legality of government acts. There is also an emerging role internationally of the third branch, Parliament itself. And we'll hear about parliamentary committees made up of actual parliamentarians, elected representatives, who are examining laws and policies for compliance with human rights. And finally, we look at Parliament as a body as a whole. And you'll hear discussion of the notwithstanding clause, or the override clause. When the Supreme Court rules 5-4 that something is unconstitutional, did they get it right? Did they have the last word? Should parliaments not be able to say, hey, we want to strike the human rights collective goals balance a little bit differently? And you'll hear about the override clause, which we have in Canada, part of one element of the basic law of Israel, proposals in Israel to expand it, and it's in the constitution of Victoria in Australia. We are privileged to have three leading experts for our panel. Let me make brief introductions. These comments do not adequately describe their experience and accomplishments. Professor Hillel Sommer received the Radzner School's Excellence in Teaching Award in 2015. He was the Dean of Student Affairs and the Vice Dean. He's published several law review articles in Israel and the United States, was an advisor to the Knesset's Constitution, Law, and Justice Commission in its most recent attempt to draft a constitution for Israel. He's also completed, which I'm very interested in, groundbreaking work on providing compensation to victims of terrorism. Professor Adam Dodek was awarded the Capital Educators Award in 2012 as one of the top teachers in Ottawa, and last year the Law Society Medal for outstanding contribution to the profession. He teaches public law and legislation, constitutional law, legal ethics, and professional responsibility, and a seminar on the Supreme Court of Canada, which I'd like to take. Professor Dodek's area of research include public law, the legal profession, the judiciary, and legal ethics. And he's the author of leading textbooks, casebooks, and a fantastic book on Chief Justice Antonio Lemaire. And I first met Adam during a stint where he was director of policy and then chief of staff to the Attorney General of Ontario. But I also have had the privilege of working with Professor Lorraine Weinrib early in my career. As some of you know, before joining the Faculty of Law at the University of Toronto, she was counsel and deputy director in the famous constitutional law branch at Ontario's Ministry of the Attorney General. She is recognized as one of Canada's foremost authorities on constitutional law. the author of numerous law review articles. She teaches constitutional law courses as well as advanced courses on the Charter, constitutional litigation, and comparative constitutional law. And Lorraine has also written extensively on Sections 1 and the Override Clause, the theoretical dimensions of the Supreme Court of Canada's Charter jurisprudence, and some really terrific in-depth case studies of leading cases under the Charter. So this is today's format. First, Professor Summer will speak for about 20 minutes about the override, followed by about 10 to 15 minutes from Professor Weinrib and Dodek. I'm then going to take short questions, no more than a minute per question, please, but you're going to be so enthralled that you're going to all be wanting to line up to ask questions. And we'll take three or four questions at once, and then the panel will answer them collectively. Second, Professor Dodek will lead off, talking a little bit about the role of attorneys general and government counsel. That'll be about 15 minutes, followed by 10 minutes of comments from the other panelists, and we will then go straight to Professor Weinrib, who will go first on the emergence of parliamentary committees and this new phenomena, and talk as well about the role of institutions in protecting human rights. That should leave another 10 to 15 minutes for audience questions, and again, I'll take three or four questions at once, and hold you to about a minute per question. Now, you will have in your materials, and I prepared some PowerPoint slides. It's just a page. We're not going to refer to the slides or project them, although Professor Summer will be projecting some slides. These just provide some background on three areas: the actual texts of override clauses in Israel and Canada, the statutory provisions that require the Attorneys General to review legislation to make sure it's complicit with the compliant with the Charter, and some of the statutory provisions worldwide, such as in England and Australia, that are requiring parliamentary committees to review bills and policy to make sure they're consistent with the Charter. So without further ado, Professor Summer.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank again the organizers of this conference, and also to thank Chief Justice Grunis for his excellent choice 44 years ago of where to go for his doctoral studies, which he could have chosen worse than this law school and city. So I'm very thankful for your choice then that brings us all here today. I have had an advantage you don't always get, which is that both Lorraine and Adam just published this year in the Israel Law Review articles about what I'm going to talk about. So I know a lot of what they think about it recently, since published much before, but I'm talking about something recent. And I'm going to try to... title I chose for my talk actually draws from Adam's paper that I just mentioned, in which he spent some time playing with the expression bête noire, explaining it in its various uses, referring to the override. And others, some of the politicians in Israel, are viewing it as a white knight that will save them from what they view as an over-activist Supreme Court. And I was trying to say that there might be a middle ground between those two attitudes, and this is what I'm going to try to do after introducing a few features. So I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to describe the Canadian override, because both the Canadians in the room and the Israelis in the room know the Canadian override, so there's no need to introduce it. I'm going to say a little bit about the existing Israeli override. The existing Israeli override basically was added to a specific basic law. Israel does not have a single document Bill of Rights. It has a Bill of Rights that is supposed to be added one law at a time, one basic law at a time. However, after the first two basic laws in 1992, the constitutional process in Israel has stopped. Once some of the political actors realized what judicial review meant, they said, we've had enough. And part of the discourse about the override in Israel has been to maybe try to facilitate the continuation of the constitutional process. So in this one basic law that deals with freedom of vocation, we have added in 1994 notwithstanding an override clause modeled to a large extent after the Canadian example, but the other human rights basic law, the most significant one, basic law human dignity and freedom, which as it turns out is currently 90% of our Bill of Rights, there is no override provision in that basic law. So when, as I mentioned before, when the step-by-step constitutional process stopped, part of the compromise, actually at that time even I think supported by Chief Justice Barak, was that if there was to be a full Bill of Rights, a full constitution, acknowledging judicial review, etc., then a well-drafted override would not be such a horrible thing. But in the last 15 years, there have been several attempts to add an override mechanism to all the basic laws, or to at least to basic law human dignity. And at this time, it is coming from a particular side of the Israeli political arena, from the right wing. They tend to be unhappy with some of the Supreme Court decisions, both sometimes in terms of the substance of the decision and in other times, in what is perceived as judicial activism. And so at this point, the proposed expansion of the override really has proponents and opponents, which are sort of clear on both sides. Many Supreme Court justices have both acting and retired have taken the position that it would be horrible to expand the override to the other Israeli basic laws. So this is not the override, as Professor Weinrib noted in her recent article. The discussion of the override in Israel is not rooted in a prolonged and wide-ranging set of negotiations by Israeli political leaders. They are the product of post-election leverage of political parties in the coalition-building process. Now, there are a few differences between Israel and Canada that need to be set out immediately now. The first is that while in Canada much of the override is aimed at preserving the balance between the provinces and the federal country, in Israel this issue is irrelevant. Override is purely a matter of parliament and the courts. And the other important difference is that while in Canada the constitutional process in general, the charter, not the override, but the constitutional process in general was at the top of the public agenda, in Israel, for many years, it was not. Those important basic laws that are our current constitution, passed with the participation of not enough of our members of parliament, and there was no significant public debate. I guess probably because we in Israel might have other bigger issues to go to elections on. This has never been the main issue on which most Israelis would go to court, the way that the constitutional system would be, and that is a big difference. And I'd like to say a few words about the newcomer to the very limited club of systems with an override, and to say a few words about the state of Victoria, Australia, which introduced the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities in 2006. So we already have a perspective of 10 years. The Victorian Charter is not a higher law Bill of Rights. It is a law that can be amended or repealed just like any other law. This, by the way, is also the current situation of basic law, human dignity and freedom in Israel, which is, even though it is called a basic law and it does have some supremacy, but it can still be amended and repealed just like any other law under the current legal system. And the Victoria system does not have judicial review. The court can issue a declaration of its inconsistent interpretation, which does not affect the validity of the law or the continuation of its use. It does not. It's got, you know, there's some process that needs to start if this happens, but it does not invalidate the law. So going to the language of the Australian override section, so if you look at the beginning of it, you'll see that if there was a copyright on text, this is drawing directly on the Canadian. The first section draws directly on the Canadian precedent, with minor changes. I'm not going to go into them. It's too specific. And what's important, I think, I'm going to move quickly. It's a pretty long section. But there's a real process set out to put the use of the override into the public arena. There has to be a prior notice that there's going to be an override proposed, and it needs to be explained why it should be. They must make a statement to the Legislative Council or the Legislative Assembly explaining the exceptional circumstances. There's a requirement that override would only be used under exceptional circumstances, which does not exist neither in Canada nor in Israel. But of course, nobody knows what those exceptional circumstances are. It's not been defined, and anything can be declared as exceptional circumstances. Subsection 4 repeats that it is the intention of Parliament that an override declaration will only be made in exceptional circumstances. And then finally, if you can take a look at subsection 6, it says that if an override declaration is made in respect of the statutory provision, then to the extent of the declaration, this charter has no application to that provision. This is a different language which has been interpreted by Australian scholars to be wider than the effect of an override as we know it in Israel and Canada. Because, for example, the Victoria Charter had a provision require an interpretative mandate requiring that all Victorian laws be interpreted in a way consistent with human rights. If there is an override under the Victoria Charter, everybody is exempt from the requirement to interpret that law as to be consistent with human rights. So this is a much broader effect than the override in Canada and Israel. And so I'm moving to my main point, which is that the override can be designed. And here we have a huge difference between the Canadian override and the initial Israeli override, both of which were not designed in an open process. That's part of the critique on the Canadian override. And in the Israeli override, there was somewhat of a discourse before, but not a prolonged process. The override in Israel had to come really quickly to save the government, the coalition, which one of the parties was threatening to leave because of something that the Supreme Court said. And so, but on the other hand, the current proposals for override in the last 15 years in Israel have done, I think, an amazing job in laying out how can an override if somebody wanted to use an override, and I'll argue that once it's designed in a certain way, maybe it's more favorable to use an override than we've thought about it before. But what are the elements that can be designed? And I'll try to demonstrate using the, I'm going to use, here, let me move to the next slide, and it will be clearer. Well, once you see it, I'm going to use Canada, Israel, the existing override. I'm going to use the wide array of proposals that have been presented in Israel in the last 15 or so years. And I'm going to use Victoria as elements. And then I'm going to try to add one additional element, which you might find puzzling at first. But if you think about it later, you might think that I may have a point. I'm not guaranteeing it. So if I look at, if you follow with me, if you'd like, the first issue is which rights can the override apply to? In Canada, there was a choice to apply the override to some of the charter provisions and not to apply it to others. In Israel, there was a choice which was based on the necessity to apply it to basic law freedom of vocation. And in the current proposals, the proposals are intent, because the proposals are aimed, among other things, to counter what is perceived as judicial activism, therefore, they are trying to make it very wide-ranging. And nobody that I've seen in Israel has said, okay, maybe some issues should be exempted from the override. I think that we know today that there are entrenched constitutional provisions in the world that cannot be amended in many countries. So there's, on a theoretical basis, there's no reason for there not to be sections that are outside the reach of the override. What are the circumstances? So I think that here Victoria, Australia has contributed to the ability to have less than an all or nothing with the override. If you can describe special circumstances, we have other areas of law where you require special circumstances. Most interestingly, don't tell anybody, but it might be the court who gets to interpret whether special circumstances existed or not. So that makes maybe the issue of who has the final word a little more complicated here. Third aspect, which has been the subject of debate in Israel, is whether the override can only be reactive after there has been a court decision which the parliament doesn't like, or also be proactive. Here again, I'm not going to go, there's great arguments for and against, but time doesn't permit me to go deep into this. But in designing, this is another thing that can be designed. I think that Israel's most interesting contribution is the issue of the majority. What is the majority required for an override? Here, first of all, you need to see what does the country in question, what are its provisions for amending the constitution? Obviously, not obviously actually, but there can be an argument for whether an override, if you can amend the constitution, you wouldn't need an override sometimes, so there is an argument to making it less. What's interesting in Israel is that Israel has been in recent years a country with coalition governments relying on fairly narrow majorities. That's the way it turns out. So the ability to use an override, if you go to the higher end of the spectrum that's been proposed in Israel, and I have given to you in percents because we had the Jewish state had to do it out of 120, so you can't calculate the exact numbers. So percentages are more interesting here than the numbers, but in general, I'd say about half the coalitions in the last 30 years could have had the 70 required which is the highest number that was mentioned in Israel. As far as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, in Canada there's not even a requirement of a majority of the entire membership, right? It could be a simple majority. In basic law, freedom of vocation, Israel went to the middle ground of having, you need 61 of the 120. You can't just, but that's still fairly easy to get. Same, Australia has the same rule as in Canada. And I think that contribution is important in designing the override mechanism. There's an issue of what's the process. In Canada, many years ago, Tzvika Hanna was here before, wrote a whole article about how many instances of notwithstanding are going. The public doesn't notice them, public doesn't even know that they existed, let alone during the process didn't know and didn't object. Reading Adam's recent work, I think that has somewhat changed. And today, there have been, Adam describes in his recent work, instances where provinces wanted to use the notwithstanding clause and override, and there was a public outcry and backed off. And in fact, the process is very interesting, I think, in that sense. And the last element before I go into the newer element that I would like to add to that does not exist in any of those is the sunset and the renewal. And here we can see, doesn't matter if it's 4 or 5 years, but it's renewable everywhere. And I think that is not necessarily the right answer. I would like, for example, combining this requirement and the issue of which majority do we need, that if you renew, you'd need a higher majority. If you renew time after time, maybe you need the same majority or very close to the one you need to amend the Constitution, because it's no longer a temporary provision, it's become a permanent provision. So if there is a higher threshold you need to meet in order to amend the Constitution, then if you've created an override time after time after time after time, you've now had 20 years, maybe you should meet the same burden as you need to amend the Constitution, especially in jurisdictions where it's very difficult to amend the Constitution because you've amended it de facto in this way. So a lot of the literature about the override places it within the who has the final say debate. Correctly puts it there. And the fear expressed in Israel was of excessive use. And part of the elements we've discussed, mostly the majority required, will obviously affect the number of times that the parliament can use the override. And if there is excessive use, then the final word lies with the parliament. If there is unlimited excessive use, then the final word at the end of the day is at the parliament, which can use the override every single time it doesn't like what the court had said. But are we, I hope I pronounced this correctly, are we over anxious about the overuse of the override? Took me time to draft this one. I had to ask my wife if it was correct in English. Or, as I would put the question that's been interesting me for most of my life, can we have our cake and eat it too? And I think that the flexibility of design may provide a solution allowing Parliament to be deemed to have the final say, while in fact leaving most of the final say with the court. Some of the elements of design already discussed may help to strike this balance. Again, the majority needed, the sunset and extension I've already discussed. Looking for a second about the experience of using the override, now that we can really also look at Victoria after 10 years, it's a much more interesting exercise. So Canada, significant overuse in the beginning, mostly by Quebec, but not only, and then very little use in recent years. All users since 1988, eventually ineffective, if I understood Adam's analysis of it, and interestingly, attempted users blocked by public objection, which is a very interesting process because the override was initially based on the fact that Parliament needs to pay a political price. Well, this is beginning to happen only now. In Israel, the override was used twice, in one matter, but twice. And after the second time it was used, it was actually the Parliament did the right thing and amended the Constitution, amended the basic law itself, in order not to require further extensions of the override. And in Victoria, now that we have almost 10 years of experience, it was used twice in almost 10 years. So what's interesting is that we see that there is not that much use, in fact. even in the places where you can use it, the use is very limited. And I, there are many reasons for that, but I'm interested right now just in the result. The result is that it is not used that much. So here's my crazy idea. How about if we limited the number of users, allowed each parliament to use the override? Assume we were to allow every parliament to use the override three times over a term. I've started this example with five. I've learned that I can say three. All users expire not 5 years or 4 years after they're made, but they expire 3 months or shortly after the new parliament comes into term. Why shortly after? To allow the new parliament to decide that this is also, these are also issues that it would like to extend. Of course, if the new parliament decides to extend the issues that had the override in the previous parliament, then they're going to be counted as part of the new parliament's quota. So there is no, if you use this method, no more need to fear overuse by parliament, right? There cannot be overuse, first of all. Secondly, I think, I'm trying to estimate what would parliament do. And judging from other areas where you have similar quotas, I'll tell you in a second what they are, parliament might refrain from using its entire quota, fearing that more important issues will come up. Okay? The one example I've used, this is coming from my experience as a parent. I don't have as many children and grandchildren as some of the speakers in the previous panel who listed them. But if you tell your kid, mostly small kids, you know, if you give them something and you tell them that they only get three of those, you will see that sometimes they won't get to the third because they really want to keep it. You know, another example is to think of a sports analogy. Basketball, you know, the basketball, the rule is that you cannot do a penalty. But the first five times you do it, first four times you do a penalty, that's not too horrible, right? You just lose the ball. But the fifth time, if you get to five times, you're out. And you know how basketball players act when they realize that they got their fourth penalty. Often the coach would take them out of the game. So there's an interesting mechanism when you have a limit on how you prepare for that limit. I think that the parliament will also be formally ranked, because if we have a quota, then it will be easy to rank parliaments. How many times have you used it? And this, in terms of the political price, might also be interesting. And if parliament decides to use its remaining quota towards the end of the term, well, that's no good, because under my proposal, those end at the end of the term. So if parliament decides to use the, it will be just a political statement 4 or 5 months afterwards, the new parliament will have to decide if it wants to waste the its quota on that, yes or no. So wait, coming to my final thing. So who has the final word under my proposal? My impression, this isn't completely Israeli impression, is that parliament appears to care more about having the final word in theory than in practice. They want to say that they have the final word. And I think that the justices of the Supreme Court, and I'm saying this, of course, in admiration, care more about the results than about than about being pronounced those who have the final word. And in this way, we may be able to satisfy them both. Thank you very much.
So we have some complimentary comments and supplementary comments, but I'm sure they'll be complimentary from Adam and Lorraine. Who would like to go first?
You want to go first? You want me to go first? That was a fabulous presentation, Hillel. Thank you. First of all, כבוד הנשיא גרונס, כבוד השופטת, ברוכים הבאים, welcome to you. Thank you very much to the organizers of the conference, to Dean Sawson, to Aviv for inviting me to participate on this really interesting panel. We're talking about institutional roles in protecting human rights, and so that's sort of the context that my three very brief comments about the notwithstanding clause are made. Hillel mentioned that the title of my Israel Law Review article about the notwithstanding clause, the bête noire of Canadian constitutional politics. And bête noire is a word in French that literally means black beast. And it has different connotations in English and in French, I was surprised to learn. In English, the connotation of it is something that is taboo, that is negative, that is the nemesis of something in whether it's in politics or in something else. In French, it has a different connotation, perhaps a little bit more literal, something that little kids fear. It's something that you fear, like a black bear or a scary monster or something like that. And so that was the entree point for the article that I wrote for the Israel Law Review, trying to really explain the history and the context of the notwithstanding clause in Canada. And so my first point is that looking back, we're now heading into 2017. There's going to be a lot of talk about Canada's 150th birthday, the 35th anniversary of a patriation, the Constitution Act, the Charter. The notwithstanding clause came very late to the game in the whole debate around constitutional rights and the protection of constitutional rights. It was not part of the draft charter that Pierre Trudeau publicly announced in October 1980 and sent to a parliamentary committee for public hearings for the first time ever on television. There were 95 witnesses, over 250 hours of testimony before that parliamentary committee, and really only a couple of witnesses mentioned the idea of an override at all. One of them very much mentioned it as a vehicle for rights protection, and that was the New Democratic Premier of Saskatchewan, Alan Blakeney. And that was one of the points of reference of the debate of who is better placed to protect rights. Is it the courts or is it the legislature? And at that time, there was very deep and legitimate skepticism, given their history, about whether the courts would be up to the job. And certainly here at a conference at Osgoode, it's certainly appropriate to recognize that scholars at Osgoode very much led the way in expressing that skepticism. People like former Dean Harry Arthurs, people like the late Michael Mandel, Professor Alan Hutchison, even after the charter was enacted. And so the notwithstanding clause was a late addition in November 1981. And there wasn't much intellectual heavy lifting certainly done at the time. When Minister of Justice Jean Chrétien explained this late addition to the Canadian people before Parliament in November 1981, he actually said that, this was actually would just be used in non-controversial matters, which we sort of chuckle because that's not how things turned out, but that also is not really consistent with the idea. And it was really only after patriation that scholars tried to bring some theoretical justification and coherence to that. People like Peter Russell and very much Lorraine Weinrib. And so when I was writing my article, I relied very much on looking back at her 1990 McGill Law Journal article on learning to live with the override. And for me, you know, as scholars, we often look back on things that we wrote 5 years ago, 10 years ago, let alone longer, and they're painful to read. For me, re-engaging with Lorraine's article was was a fabulous experience to see an article that stands the test of time and that also sort of brings, created a paradigm or created a structure for a road not taken by the Supreme Court, a road not taken in Canadian politics about the override. And of course, in the next decade, we had other scholars such as Tzvi Kahana and very much Peter Hogg try and make sense of the override and its place in rights protection in Canada. As you heard from Hillel, certainly the political story since they wrote, and they're writing in the Peter in 1995, and subsequent years, and Tzvi in the early 2000s, the override has very much become delegitimized in terms of a tool of rights protection in Canada. And that's why I wrote or spoke about it in Israel, because it's a different sort of debate in Israel. And, for me on this panel, that's where sort of talking about the override ends, and we'll talk about other issues, other potential actors, other potential institutions for rights protection, at least in Canada.
I'm going to begin with just one comment about Hillel's wonderful new suggestion on a little bit more structure for the use of the override, and then I want to continue along the lines of Adam's comments. I was struck, Hillel, by your comment that number of uses would reflect some sort of measure of the degree of encroachment on rights. And I wonder if that actually would make sense. First of all, the idea that an override would be in place and maybe renewed would produce enormous anxiety among the people whose rights are actually affected. And also, any particular override clause could have an enormous impact on the enjoyment of rights for a great number of people, and those rights could be the kind of rights which affect the core of their status as citizens or their human dignity. I'm actually thinking of the example of the Quebec Charter of Values and the override discussion about that. Initially, it was said that there were legal opinions that an override wouldn't have to be used, and then there was a reversal of that, the claim that there were opinions from the Department of Justice in Quebec to that effect. But the Quebec Charter of Values would have signified such a denial of equality to identity communities and also to women within the identity communities. It would have been a transformation of people's ability to work and to access public services because of wearing external symbols of religion. So I'm intrigued by your idea, but I think that the idea that this would measure something significant gives me pause. One of the things that's fascinating about the institutional structure of protecting rights is how ideas that are so deeply normative that we all share can become the subject matter of such tremendous complication in a particular political environment, a political constitutional state, but also how transforming it is to look at these issues comparatively. And one of the things that I believe very strongly, and it was the conclusion of the article that I just published in the Israel Law Review, that the notwithstanding clause is a feature of the charter that one has to be very careful about transplanting to a very different institutional and political context. I actually think that the override clause, the notwithstanding clause, has served the project of rights protection. And it's a great irony, and I in a sense, that it did that. And there were many fortuities of the maturation of the understanding of the constitutional imperatives in Canada that brought us to the point where we can look back and say that the notwithstanding clause has actually protected rights. At the time, of course, those of us who were involved in the constitutional project will remember that Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau accepted the notwithstanding clause as the price for getting a strong charter, strong in the sense of the most expansive statement of the rights that had been under consideration, the narrowest and most normative expression of the limitation clause, and the price that he paid for an uncompromised a draft of the Charter of Rights was to concede the override clause, and he regretted it bitterly. And publicly, he continued to regret it and commit himself to having it removed one day from the charter until he left political life. But in private conversation with him and on three public occasions, I argued very strongly that he didn't have to have such strong regret. And at least on those occasions, I was able to convince him. But one of the things that I find most interesting is that the incredibly strong demand that the Canadian public made for a strong charter was I think that the primary it is definitely, according to the history, the reason that we got the charter that we got. And it's also the reason that the notwithstanding clause has not become more than an exceptional and indeed an objectionable part of the charter in terms of actually using it. The presence of the notwithstanding clause, however, is very important because it has blunted a lot of the very strong criticism that we have seen in other rights-protecting jurisdictions against the court. We've had strong criticism of the court's role and, of course, of specific rulings, but it has not been nearly as negative and poisonous as what we've seen in the United States and what we still see in Israel. And part of it is because it's very hard for members of the public or political parties or party in power to castigate courts for exercising their constitutional role or deciding certain cases in certain ways when the legislature, by simple majority, can just take the political price of reversing the position. In this, actually, let me just make one short comment about the article that Adam read. I'm actually not sure that anyone has ever read that whole article. When I look back at that article, I can't believe how dense it was. And I want to mention why it was so dense. I wrote that article just as I was making the transition between being a litigator in the Ministry of the Attorney General of Ontario and becoming a professor at the University of Toronto Faculty of Law. I had, just before that transition, argued on behalf of Ontario the leading case on the notwithstanding clause. Quebec, as some of you may remember, had used the notwithstanding clause in the most maximal way possible. It had put a notwithstanding clause in every statute for the maximal period and had used a standard form formulation so that it didn't specify which rights it was overriding. So it was, in some ways incoherent politically, because it wasn't pointed directly at the outrage of having the charter adopted against Quebec's will. But it wasn't even about the role of the courts or about particular charter decisions. On behalf of Ontario, I argued that there was an insufficient specificity in the use of the notwithstanding clause, and the court was apoplectic that anyone would make any suggestion that the court would have to judicially review an exercise of an override clause, and so they were, most members of the court were very, very resistant to actually engaging the idea that there could be some sort of judicial review as to whether the exercise of the override power had been done compliant with the terms. So I wasn't successful in that argument, but I was successful on the argument that the override could not be used retroactively, which is one of the ways that Quebec had used it at that time. And I must say, I remember walking through the halls of the Ministry of the Attorney General's Constitutional Law Branch and engaging all my colleagues in the discussion of whether the override could be used retroactively. And all my colleagues said, well, we can legislate retroactively, so I don't see the problem here. And I must say I was very, very bothered by that. And I was successful in that argument. And actually, it's one of the things that I'm most proud of in terms of my career as a litigator, because no one else read the record carefully enough to realize that had been done. And the people were shocked when I pointed it out, and the court did sustain the non-retroactivity. Now, so I think that should be added to the list of the qualifications, because it's a judge-made qualification on the exercise of the override. I think that's enormously important, because as we have all seen, if governments had the power today to threaten that next Tuesday they will retroactively override my right to do any of the charter-protected activities today, then no one would have any charter rights in regard to the rights that are subject to the override. If a government doesn't have to actually use the override, could just threaten and freeze people's rights, that would be an incredible encroachment on people's constitutional entitlements. And when I wrote that article, I wanted very much to have to get down on paper in a public forum, the detail of the arguments in that case, because I had done so much research and thinking about it, and I thought that it was very important to understand that temporal restriction, that non-retroactivity, was a companion piece to the five-year limit. One of the arguments I made to the court is that if you can, how can you have a five-year limit if you can do it retroactively? If you can do it retroactively for 5 days or 2 years or 5 years, can you do it retroactively 5 years and prospectively 5 years? It seemed to me that the five-year perspective limit had to be the rule and with no retroactivity. Now, I want to just conclude with a note of comment about constitutional transplants. The Israeli political system is such that it was able to take so much from our charter in terms of the normative content. But the political system is so different from our political system that I think this dynamic which has built up to endorse the exceptionality of the override power and the stigma that comes with a government on a majoritarian basis of legitimacy erasing anyone's rights. This is something that I think resonates in both countries, but the institutional structure does not resonate in the same way. The article I wrote in the Israel Law Review goes through a renewed view of the history. I've written about the history a number of times, but there's been a lot published since I've reviewed that history, and so I wanted to take the new reminiscences and documents that have been released and go back to the history of the development. And I think that I was able to present much more about what the nature of the provincial opposition to the adoption of the charter. But the more original research was that I examined the public record of all the uses and non-uses of the charter, and I went through almost 2,000 newspaper articles trying to understand what the discourse of the decision not to use the override had been. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about that research is that what has developed is a kind of proportionality analysis of uses of the override. And the metaphors have changed over the years. I wasn't able to go back. I started noticing the metaphors too late in my research. And so one day I will go back and reread all that and actually trace the development of the metaphors. But the dominant metaphor for use of the notwithstanding clause now is that it is a nuclear weapon. And I think that and the other metaphors that were used, which I haven't collected systematically, that metaphor demonstrates that the dominance of rights and justified limits and the need for the state to justify and the justification having to be under Section 1, under the very structured, delineated tests that we have, and then, but under the notwithstanding clause, it's a political forum, but the idea that it's outrageous to take away people's rights, which are our highest and deepest norms under the Charter, and that we have not had an occasion yet where that the proportionality of doing that is justified. Let me just close in saying that complexity of our political structures have protected us. Our federalism, our bicameralism at the national level, our constituencies, the great geographic diversity of Canada. Israel has none of those bulwarks against the use of the override. And this is for this reason, I actually do fear that it would be used so much that it would not engage the same kind of high normative and institutional exceptionality that we have developed in Canada, and which I think has led to the abandonment of its use as a political option. The other point is the very strong public desire for the Charter in Canada has been sustained in very, very strong respect for the Supreme Court's judgments under the Charter, the judicial role. Even when the statistics show this, that even when people disagree with a judgment, they believe that it is the court's role to produce those judgments in the way it's producing the judgments. None of that seems to prevail in Israel. And the coalition agreements, small parties, religious parties, nationalist parties, single issue voters to a greater extent than in Canada, a political party list, no constituencies, Israel is so diverse, but none of that, very little of that diversity really comes through in the political lists and the proportional representation. And so there's so many built-in, almost invisible features which have stymied the use of the override here are simply not present in Israel. And my last point is quite simply, I do not see in Israel that there's much political pressure to add a notwithstanding clause, except from people who really do not like the values of the constitutional rights protection and the role of the court in protecting those values.
Wow. Notwithstanding that I've lost track of time, control of time, and I am going to not override the request that if people do have questions on the notwithstanding of the override clause, now is the time to come up with quick questions.
I have have two questions. What is in relation to this three-time use
suggestion, which I couldn't see working in Canada? Perhaps it's necessary in Israel. My concern would be, maybe like the candy analogy, whether a three-time cap could also be seen as permission. And I'm wondering what you think about that. And my question for you, Professor Weinrib, is whether Israel, for all the reasons that you talked about, the need for a notwithstanding clause and the value of the notwithstanding clause here in Canada, wouldn't Israel then need it more in order to, not that it's happened so far, perhaps lead the way to a constitution, a bill of rights, and to deal with the really big issue in Israel, which is the delegitimization of the courts?
Thank you.
I think that I tried to answer before saying that I don't think that if you give a quota of three, it will always be used. The number is, anybody can put any number they want. You can do the same proposal with one use. The statistics that I put of what was used in Canada, Israel, and Victoria shows that the number is more than needed. So the parliament cannot say, and I said, I used to say five in the past. So, but the big part of my answer to you, Lauren, to your question is that I'm thinking as an Israeli, you have a charter. This is not, the issue is not we have a whole Bill of Rights, should we add an override clause to it? We're living in a country where the head, the leader of the one of the religious parties who is actively stopping the continuing process has announced that even if, as a constitution to the state of Israel, somebody would propose the Ten Commandments, he would object because he would be worried of the way the Supreme Court would interpret the Ten Commandments. This is an actual quote, okay? So the Israeli Democracy Institute, which is an important factor within the Israeli academia, has proposed, not liking the override, has proposed something which I personally think is much worse, which is to take whole areas of our public life and take them of our legal life and take them out of the possibility of the court to strike down laws of the Knesset, for example, everything that's security related. Okay, I think that's much worse. So, thinking not as a Canadian, but as an Israeli who would like to see this process advancing, this is a compromise. I'm trying to build a compromise which I think can work and not be so bad.
I was just thinking also about the the three uses. Just another detail came to my mind is that the life of a government in Israel is so uncertain they might use all three chances in the first month.
that should be entrenched.
Another point that is interesting in Israel, it's more graphic than here, but when you have the override kind of takes the political, attracts the political energy. And so if you want to do something, the override is an option. In Israel, where there isn't an override for the problems that people want an override to address, you have an identification by political parties as to whether they support rights protection or not, and whether they support the rule of law or not, and support the court or not, it seems to me there's no potential for this, given that genesis, to be a viable instrument that will be used in a temperate way.
Okay, let's go to the Dean Sawson, your question.
Yeah, so I had a question building on Lorraine, your reference to the proposed Quebec law and other kind of concrete instances when this could be used. Because in a way, the overuse by Quebec early on is kind of innocuous. It wasn't about a particular right that a government sought to infringe. It was everything to the greatest extent on principle, irrespective of what the issue was, and not exempting from the Quebec Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms. It wasn't an anti-rights movement. It was an anti-federal government and federal intrusion piece. But, you know, we're having this discussion in the prelude to a big debate tonight south of the border. we've seen in Europe and in the U.S., and we shouldn't get on too high a horse here, how easy it is to generate these kind of xenophobic and nativist concerns. And so when I look at the notwithstanding clause in that context, again, keeping in mind the historical moment when you could argue it was useful in that beginning period when everyone was nervous about rights, just like the disallowance power, which seems horridly anti-democratic to us now, when you look at what it was used for, it was mostly striking down anti-Asian legislation in BC and places like that that were horrifically discriminatory. So it had a time and a place. Do you have reservations, and this is really, Hillel, for you as well, about the use of this in a specific way and at a specific time when it's the most disenfranchised members of society who will bear the brunt of it? So in the abstract, I'm all for it. It has some great democratic symmetry, and the political scientist in me is very attracted to the nuances of three strikes, you're out, stuff like that. I agree, and as a parent, I'm bonding with you. But whenever I get specific and look at an actual instance and pick the most vulnerable group you care most about and then apply it there, I wouldn't want to live in that society. So what makes you want to live in that society, and how do, again, the Canadians on the panel wrestle with their own sense of how this actually could be used, honored in the breach, as it were?
I think, Lauren, what you're raising sort of prompts me to go a bit more deeply into my thinking about this. I think there are two ways of understanding the Rights Protecting Project and the exclusive task of the judges to adjudicate on individual rights claims and all the elaborate way in which we construct charter litigation. One way is to think of it as, and I think this is the dominant way, it is a progression that takes us away from the organizing principle that pre-existed, which was legislative supremacy. And so the courts are usurping or undermining the dominant organizing feature of our pre-charter legislative system, which was legislative supremacy and majority rule. Legislatures being elected, representative, accountable, and working by majority rule. The other way of looking at it is not with that historical projection or that presupposition about the deep normativity of parliamentary supremacy, but to think of the Constitution expressing the deepest norms of our social and political ordering, and both creating and restraining the use of all public power. In this, the Charter of Rights becomes supreme law when we perform constitutional amendment according to the rules. Many of our greatest judges, the judges we revere, were judges like President Barak, who found rights protection in the very basic architectural structure, to use that image, of the constitutional system, whether there was a formalization of it in a written instrument or not. I think of Rand, of Laskin, many others. Okay, so, well, not so many others, but our greatest judges. Okay, so the other, in the second model of thinking of the Constitution as supreme law and protecting our deepest norms, the Charter of Rights adds to the fortifies, it expands the normativity of our system by giving courts the exclusive power to adjudicate on rights, and that is what legitimates majority rule. In our diverse societies, where we don't believe that the purpose of the constitutional order is to preserve. The existing moral faith-based structure. When we think of our diversity as our strength, and we think of human rights as the framework and not religious norms, and not preservation of the past, then we have to have another normative structure, and the courts give that to us by having this very organic mode of analyzing every challenge, every non-normative challenge to our normative rights-based order. In that model, then, the point you make, the answer to your question, and the point you make is absolutely obvious, that majorities cannot deny the equal and inherent human dignity and rights of citizenship, and just rights to survive and live your own life by your own values that the modern world offers. And the, to the extent that the override re-empowers legislatures to do it, even in the restricted way that they do in Canada, it is not permissible. In our environment, we've been very, very lucky. How long that luck will last, I don't know. It may be determined tonight by midnight. But just to the extent that I understand the Israeli system, I just don't see this as a step that would improve the situation at all. And I agree with President Barak that at a later stage, when there's a lot on the table, and there's a lot of give and take, and there are a lot of very, very strong feelings about any progress on rights protection or further rigidification of the constitutional order, then, you know, the question of how a notwithstanding clause might fit in should be a matter of deliberation. But I think that the there's just, to me, there's no way of understanding that this is a step that is faithful to the second understanding of our constitutional structure.
So I'm a little concerned about the time, but I see Professor Dodek is going to weigh in, and then Professor Sommer, and then we'll move on to the next topic.
Sure. Let me make a brief response to both to Dean Sawson's question and to Noah Mendelson Aviv's question. Dean Sawson said, you know, this appealed to him as a political scientist. Let me speak to you as a political scientist. I think our Constitution is inevitably wrapped up in our history, in our experience, and in the politics, which is why I sort of reiterate Lorraine's comments about the cautious or the danger of constitutional transplants. For us, we can't, in talking about moving forward on the notwithstanding clause, we cannot escape the 35 years of our history as to how and in what context that was used and how that delegitimized the notwithstanding clause. Another political scientist who was a teacher of mine, Chris Manfredi at McGill, wrote that as a defender of the notwithstanding clause, our view would have been very different had it been used in other circumstances, such as after Askov, as Karl Barr mentioned, or, he said, after Seaboyer, which was a case where the Supreme Court of Canada struck down the rape shield provision, which protected victims of sexual assault from being cross-examined about their sexual history. That was a case involving clearly a vulnerable minority. If the government had used the notwithstanding clause to protect the rights of a vulnerable minority, maybe we would have had a different narrative and a different view of the notwithstanding clause. But that's sort of in the realm of what could have been. We have to deal with what we have here in Canada and what is and what could be, which is why I find Professor Sommer's proposal, I would say, deliciously provocative as we head to a reception. And it's not surprising to me that the first person jumping up to respond and ask a question about that is from the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. Because I think we could all imagine that in Canada, the idea of a three-use limit per parliament would not be a limit, would become a license. And what perhaps in Israel would be a ceiling would become a floor. And so we could all just sort of think about, during the course of the last three parliaments, what are various laws that could have been immunized by this sort of proposal.
I'm not sure my proposal works in Canada because, first of all, you need to decide if it's three users per province. You know, even that issue alone doesn't
it's
work.
It's always about division of powers.
Maybe you should. Maybe so. You know. So, but let me say every Israeli law student and most Israeli citizens know that if I had to evaluate how much did each body in Israel contribute to human rights in Israel, the court would take 90% of the. Of what was done for human rights in Israel and the parliament. Okay, I've been too generous. 10% is a lot for parliament. I don't know if one, but even though, and I've personally written on some occasions against some of the expansions which I thought the Supreme Court have done. But I'm very happy with the result. Even when I write against the process, I always say that I'm very happy with the result. But okay. So we're in a different position, and I understand why the Canadians say, hey, we have a notwithstanding clause that's almost not used anymore. Why are you trying to... But I'm standing here with a coalition that is one party away. One party. We have several parties in the current coalition. There's one party that's saving the status of the Supreme Court and judicial review in Israel. If this one party, which has other interests, which might not be in the same position after the next day, and people who know Israeli politics know who I'm talking about, we wouldn't be in the same position. And I think this is the right time to get a very well-entrenched constitution. It's not going to change for the better. And if the price to pay for a well-entrenched constitution is limited, by the way, the three times does not stand by itself. I'm reminding you that I've shown you a lot of other aspects of design. Three times, you need the supermajority. Take issues. This is part of an answer to Professor Sossin's question. I'm reminding you that even in Canada, some things are outside the scope of the notwithstanding. You can take some of the stuff out. By the way, in Israel, I'm really safe because, let me tell you, the first override in Israel, if there was a three times rule, every parliament would start with an override on the issue of drafting the ultra-Orthodox to the army. So one has already been used. And that one actually fits within Chief Justice Gounis's attitude towards it, so it works perfectly in all aspects.
Thanks very much. So I'm going to override the agenda somewhat. We'll go with Professor Dodek, and then we'll follow immediately by Professor Weinrib on her area. And then if there is time, we'll have questions. The reception starts at 6:15, but I'd like to try and finish a little earlier than that so we can take a break.
Thanks, Hart. In the interest of time, I'll try and truncate my remarks a little bit, be peppy. I'll certainly be provocative at this late hour of the day. So if we're talking about institutional options for rights protection, I want to talk for a moment about the Attorney General. I had the honor of working for the Attorney General of Ontario. I also had the honor of clerking for Justice Yitzhak Zamir, one of the former Attorney General of Israel. We have in Chief Justice Barak, another former Attorney General of Israel, and we have in the Honorable Erwin Kotler, another Attorney General of Canada. In public law theory and in statute, the Attorney General is supposed to be the guardian of the public interest, the protector of the rule of law, and a guarantor of human rights. The Honorable Roy McMurtry, who served as Chief Justice of Ontario, as well as Attorney General of this province for a decade, from 1975 to 1985, wrote that the Attorney General has unique responsibilities to the Crown, to the courts, to the legislative and executive branch of government. He said that the Attorney General is accountable political, but is also supposed to be aloof from partisan politics. Said that he must, of necessity, occupy a different position politically from all other ministers of the Crown. And he quoted Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, who stated that the obligations of the Attorney General were first to the Crown, second to the House, and only then to the government. Now, I would say that in Canada, These words today in 2016 seem rather quaint. And picking up on the theme of comparativism, we have in Israel and in Canada two countries, two systems that got the office of the Attorney General from the English influence, but they developed in very different ways. Of course, as Israelis all know, there is a Yoetz HaMishpati LaMemshala, there is a Attorney General to the government, an Attorney General, and there is a Sar HaMishpatim. There is a Minister of Justice, and they are two different people. One is a politician and the other is not. That is not the case in Canada. The Canadian Attorney General at the federal level and at all of the provincial levels has also doubled as the Minister of Justice, a member of cabinet, an elected politician who has policy responsibilities for justice policy. There is an inherent tension that has always been recognized but not fully appreciated between those two roles. Now, how did that play out in the early charter years? James Kelly, who's a political scientist at Concordia, wrote a book in 2005 called Governing with the Charter. It's a superb book. He based it upon his study and interviews with Department of Justice lawyers, attorneys general, federal justice, provincial justice officials, and he found that within the federal Department of Justice and within provincial departments of justice, there was the development of a charter culture in the 1990s and early 2000s, of respect for charter values and for charter law that had developed. It was attributed, he attributed it to leadership at the highest levels at the in the political realm as well as in the public service. Prime Ministers Mulroney, Chrétien, and Martin, and to ministers of justice who took the charter seriously and were willing to champion it within government and to go to the Prime Minister if necessary. Ministers of justice like Kim Campbell, Alan Rock, Anne McClellan, Martin Cochon, and of course, Erwin Kotler. But I think something happened over the past decade to the Office of the Attorney General in Canada. After Mr. Kotler left office as Attorney General, I think that his successors largely resolved the tension between their duty to the Crown and their duty to the government of the day in favor of fidelity to party and to political platform. And let me be clear, this is not just a Stephen Harper Conservative Party problem. Here in Ontario, we have a new Attorney General, Yasser Naqvi, who is my MPP and an alumni of our school and someone I consider a personal friend, who is not only the Attorney General and Minister of Justice, but he is also the government house leader. He is in the position, the most partisan position within government. It is his responsibility to promote and defend the government's legislative and political agenda at the same time as he is being asked to be aloof, to be independent from partisan politics. This has all led me to conclude that in Canada, the fusion of the role of the Attorney General and the Minister of Justice has become increasingly problematic. And I will give you three quick reasons why I think this is so. First, I think we have to realize that in lawyers' terms, there is an inherent conflict of interest in having a minister who is responsible for developing legislation and policy, and that same person as Attorney General providing the legal advice on his or her own legislative policy. In you know, there's the old adage that a lawyer who has a client who represents himself has a fool, a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client, right? I thank the Israelis in the audience for helping me with that. Right? There's something really problematic about that. Second, when I look, to me, sort of the key moment of the epiphany in this was the attack in 2014 by the Harper government on the Supreme Court, specifically attacking the integrity of Chief Justice McLaughlin. Writing about that incident in The Walrus in January 2015, Lawrence Austin was characteristically generous and I would say restrained in his criticism, stating that Prime Minister Harper's attack on the Chief Justice showed a lack of political leadership. Prime Minister Harper's biographer, John Ibbotson was not so generous. In his book published during the 2015 election campaign, Ibbotson described the incident as the nadir for Prime Minister Harper, the lowest point in the fortunes of a person or an organization. But for me, I'm far more interested in the Attorney General in this incident. And I believe that this may very well have been the nadir for the office of the Attorney General in Canada. That's because the Minister of Justice and the Attorney General of Canada not only failed to defend the Supreme Court, but actively participated in the drive by smearing the justice, Chief Justice of Canada. The episode, I think, has stained the office of the Attorney General of Canada and is an embarrassment for the highly professional Federal Department of Justice. And I doubt that history will look very kindly on the actions of the Attorney General, Minister of Justice of the day. Lastly, the decline of lawyers in politics. With that decline, it has become increasingly common in recent decades to see non-lawyers occupy the position of Attorney General and Minister of Justice in provincial governments. In my mind, there's no problem with a non-lawyer occupying the position of Minister of Justice in the same way there's no problem with a non-teacher being Minister of Education or a non-doctor being Minister of Health. But having a non-lawyer be the official legal advisor to the Crown, who is supposed to be defending the integrity of the judiciary, doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. The Attorney General, in making the Charter, we relied on that position to be the defender of the Charter within government. A specific section was added to the Department of Justice Act, section 4.1, which you have before you, which, taking on from the Canadian Bill of Rights Act, put a special obligation on the Attorney General to be an advocate for rights protection within government and to make sure that all legislation complied with the Canadian Bill of Rights and then with the Charter, and if not, to report any inconsistency to the House of Commons. That has never happened, and what happened in the Schmidt case, which I won't get into for time, is the Schmidt case where a former Department of Justice lawyer brought an action against the Attorney General for failing to live up to his statutory responsibilities, exposed the entire process within the Department of Justice, which was aimed not to protect rights, but to come up with any possible reason why, any credible argument to defend the legislation and not to trigger the Attorney General's responsibilities under the Department of Justice Act. So if we're talking about institutional rights protection, In my belief, the notwithstanding clause has not been the answer. The Attorney General, who historically was a defender and was supposed to be a defender of human rights and of charter rights, that position has been exposed to be seriously flawed. So then the next question is, what are other options? And for that, I turn things over to Lorraine.
One of the most interesting developments in the Commonwealth in terms of rights protection has not been the path that Canada took to entrenching a formal supreme law status constitutional Bill of Rights, because of course in many Commonwealth contexts that's not possible, but rather the invigoration of a new role for parliamentary committees in protecting rights. We see this perhaps most prominently in the United Kingdom itself, but there are other developments in other places where the kickback, so to speak, against the exclusive judicial authority to adjudicate on particular rights claims is the invigoration of parliaments understanding themselves as not being subject to an exclusive mandate over the Constitution by the courts, but rather understanding that the constitutional framework imposes certain obligations and vests certain powers in various institutions of government. And Parliament has not been disarmed in terms of its ability to protect rights. Rather, it has simply not activated the mechanisms that parliaments can put in place in order to vigorously protect the constitutional structure, the rule of law, constitutional rights per se, but also human rights more generally and international law. Now, just to save time, I'm not going to talk about the particular instances of national adoption of this elements of this model, but rather to turn directly to a very interesting document developed just in the last few years called the Draft Principle and Guidelines on the Role of Parliaments in Protection and Realization of the Rule of Law and Human Rights. This is part of a larger UN project to increase and establish parliamentary involvement in human rights protection across the world, civil law, common law, old countries, new countries, formal constitutions, informal constitutions. The undertaking is designed to transform the debate and the understanding of the impropriety of the roles of courts and legislatures in the modern world of constitutional rights protection. The project is very much beginning. There is the aspiration that there will be a lot of research on the contributions of these of existing parliamentary committees so dedicated, an increase in the comparative work on this, the delineation of best practices, commitment to developing methods for building the capacities of parliaments to engage in rights protection directly. The idea is not to oust the courts or leave the courts aside. The courts maintain their exclusive jurisdiction to decide individual disputes. The idea is that parliaments can reduce the opportunities that courts must entertain of dealing with private disputes if they hold their executive officials and their governments and the parliament itself to higher standards of fulfilling the obligations upon the state to abide by the constitutional order and the rights that are contained in the constitutional order, including common law rights and also to protect international human rights norms. Okay, so the primary commitments stated abstractly are that the primary responsibility to secure that national law complies with these higher law standards, it lies in the work of the legislature. So what is the institutional instantiation of this commitment? Well, what we are seeing developed and what the United Nations wants to sponsor and facilitate the development of is specialized parliamentary human rights committees that are dedicated specifically and only to protecting human rights and the rule of law and the constitutional order. To incorporate a human rights culture in all parliamentary functions. To ensure access to specialized expert advice on rights and these other issues Beyond the general legal support now offered to these three existing parliamentary committees, to empower these committees to proactively seek advice from experts, to give them recourse to, and independence in their work on human rights, and to provide, to use these expert parliamentary committees that are dedicated as a speciality to deal with human rights, to share their expertise with other parliamentary committees, and to inform the whole parliamentary process. All of that premised on the idea that there'll be the proper allocation of budget and resources. The committees themselves are to be permanent committees, joint committees if there's a general structure, established and maintained by Parliament as bodies in which individuals can build expertise and experience in performing this function. There should be guarantees of independence. There should be arrangements so these committees are nonpartisan and that they are not dominated by government members, that they engage in a pluralistic examination with strong connections to civil society, that they develop and are provided the expertise and experience necessary to deal with the intricate problems of factual records and historical material and social policy deliberations. The chairs of the committees should be senior parliamentarians of proven independence. The powers of these committees should be both reactive and proactive. They should have the capacity to compel witnesses, including government ministers, to compel production of papers and to institute oral hearings, to conduct visits within their nation state and also beyond in order to develop a wide-ranging expertise, to have access without notice to all places of detention. And with the serious problem of abuse in our incarceration institutions, this seems to be a striking detail. These bodies would be able to initiate debate on its annual reports or on pressing subjects as they come up, to propose amendments to legislation, and even to introduce bills within its mandate. So this is very broad-ranging and ambitious. The staff would be specialized, and in the British example, it's very interesting, very prominent, respected human rights lawyers in practice and academics have been stepped into leadership roles on these committees, and there should be a stipulation that these people should actually be in position and fully independent and not on secondment from other parts of the government or from NGOs. The first order responsibility would to have preview, rather than judicial review, political preview of all government bills. And this would include, and this goes to what Adam was speaking about, a requirement on the executive to report to Parliament on the compatibility of proposed legislation or amendments and attach a memorandum, not just a statement, to every bill. We've been very reluctant to have the opinions on constitutionality in Canada released. And having been a person who wrote some of those in my day in the government, I understand the reasons for that. But my reading of this material on this from the United Nations suggests that there should be a public memorandum. It may not be the full actual opinion, but one should know what the government's view is of the scope of the right, the possible breaches, and the possible justification positions. There should be an identification of opportunities for Parliament to move proactively to protect rights. There should be an examination of executive response to human rights judgments of national courts and international courts. This is very important because I don't think we've ever had anyone do a serious comprehensive study of the aftermath of court judgments and the rendering of remedies in Canada. But we know anecdotally that very often absolutely nothing happens. There's a court ruling which we celebrate and we use as precedent, and yet on the ground though that remedy is not delivered. And so this would give an institutional structure for routinely following up and pressing government to deal with these remedial vacuums, and not have people have to go back to court again and again if they have the resources to press the court to intensify the remedy. There would be, the rest of it goes to international human rights, and I don't want to take the time to do that. I just want to say that there are special provisions in this report about the working methods of these committees, the separation of powers issues that come up, training and research services, and testing the effectiveness. I just want to say again, this seems to become a mantra, I think this would work very well in Canada. As an academic who has gone to the House of Commons and the Senate committees over the years when there have been constitutional issues being debated in terms of legislation or proposed legislation, in which I felt I was competent to make a contribution, I would accept invitations to these committees. And I must say, I have always been impressed with how serious these committees are, but also how incapacitated they are by the lack of the expertise they need to actually understand what the professors are saying. I mean, the professors are all over the map on these issues, of course, but for the parliamentary committees, in a very short space of time, to build up the expertise to evaluate the bombardment of so many different suggestions, the idea of having dedicated committees that build up the expertise and have their own experts, this would be an enormous contribution. And of course, it would mean that one doesn't have to actually start up one of these investigatory hearings every time there's a problem. So I think that this would be a wonderful addition to Canada, and it would also be a way of dealing with the current government's commitment to have more and more talented people appointed to the Senate. This would be a wonderful job. The Senate committee has been very good. Many people I know who I regularly ask people who go to both the House of Commons and the Senate committee which committee actually seems to be doing a better job. And invariably, people tell me the Senate committee. And it's because a lot of the senators have been there for years and years and years. They're not as partisan as the members of Parliament. They're not given their marching orders. And they just seem to have much more depth in the ability to do this. I wonder whether in Israel, if the Knesset is the place where this kind of independence and regulation of government options in order to be compliant with national and international human rights standards and constitutionalism at large would actually operate. And this is why there are sort of other spots of independence and expertise in Israel where we see something along these lines developing, and I think it's not an accident that we don't see it developing in the parliamentary context, but it doesn't have to be in the parliamentary context. But how wonderful to think that this is an unused resource where that can be made an engine of rights protection in ways that would relieve the burden on the courts and alleviate the court's legislature conundrum.
Well, I see the wine is poured at the back, and I know that technically we have 10 minutes, but let me do this. We were going to have the others comment. Maybe we could incorporate that into any questions that people may have, or you may not have any, but if there are any, why don't we take them now? Yeah. But the questions have to be 60 seconds.
Well, I'll talk fast like Svi. Two quick comments on both. I was impressed with Lorraine's because in the 80s when I worked with the late Chief Justice Jules Deschaine on a submission to the United Nations Human Rights Committee, it was well known that the Human Rights Committee was dominated by the countries most concerned about its work, which were the countries then violating human rights. So maybe what's happening in the UK reflects the fact that the current Prime Minister of the UK is opposed to the European Commission on Human Rights and wants to withdraw, so maybe this is an opportunity for them to be stronger. We're in better shape. The Senate committee, that when I appeared in April, it was a week after Murray Sinclair's appointment. He arrived at the committee as an observer and for the first time met the chair and the staff, and he's now a member of the committee. And a committee with Murray Sinclair on it talking about justice is one that I would have a lot of time for. So on Adam's side, I want to reinforce what he was arguing, because I thought I only knew about faraway history, but there's three instances I'm familiar with where the premier of a province simultaneously served as attorney general. The two most recent cases were that I know of were Maurice Duplessis in Quebec, who was both premier and attorney general. Ernest Manning in Alberta was both premier and attorney general. These were in the 50s. The third one was Duff Batulo in British Columbia in the 1930s. And he was not even a lawyer, and he was sufficiently embarrassed about that he asked the cabinet to make him a King's Counsel, which they promptly did.
Okay. I don't think there was a question there. But let's have a question. Yeah.
I think I can turn an observation into a question.
Thank you, Harry.
Lorraine quite rightly said, anecdotally, how many cases have there been where wonderful victories have been achieved for human rights and civil liberties, and nothing happens? Would the panel, to take you back to the beginning of this afternoon's discussion, agree that there is therefore implicit in every constitutional regime a very effective and frequently used notwithstanding clause?
So that's an interesting question, and Adam, why don't we start with you, if you'd like. I mean, one of the issues that often comes up in Canada is whether we need to use the notwithstanding clause, because we can reenact legislation to respond to minimal impairment and fine-tune it, and we see that with the prostitution legislation that followed the Supreme Court's decision, which in some respects some people say is even more strict than it was before. But is there in Canada an ability to not withstand the decision of the courts by ignoring them?
Well, I think in the interest of time, I'm going to duck that question.
Okay.
And maybe just reiterate Lorraine's call for more empirical research on what actually happens after court decisions.
And Hillel, let me ask you, there was a brief exchange you had with our guest of honor regarding, in Israel, the ruling regarding the Orthodox in the army. And I think, if I heard you correctly, you said it was effectively overruled by the Knesset. And I'm wondering if that bodes ill for your proposal that 3 months after a new government comes to power, they have to notwithstand if they could get away with it in this instance.
This is really a complicated, I can also use the argument that it's because of the time, but it's really too complicated, too specific an issue,
yes,
to bring it within the framework of a general constitutional design question. But I think that in general, and there are people in the first row who would answer this question much better than me, I think that currently we're in a pretty good shape about how judgments of the Supreme Court are obeyed and implemented in Israel. I don't think it's not perfect, it will never be perfect, but I think we're in a pretty good shape.
Great. And just Adam, on the last point, and then I'll call it quits, I just wanted to share that in New Zealand, the decisions of the Attorney General or the advice of the Attorney General are made public with some redactions, and recently the court there referred to the Attorney General's comments on prisoners being allowed to vote in granting a declaration that the law prohibiting prisoners from voting violated the New Zealand Bill of Rights. So you actually see a combination of the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch all working together in those instances. So big round of applause for our wonderful panelists. Thank you all for your patience.
Well, dear guests, hi. My name is Aviv Gaon, and I'm a PhD student here at Osgoode Hall Law School. I'm honored and excited to welcome the former Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada, Professor Erwin Kotler. When Dean Sossin suggested that I will be the one to welcome Professor Kotler, I thought, how hard could it be? I can probably